The following message, How to Learn the Fear of God, was based on Habakkuk 1, verses 5 through 11. This message was delivered to the adult Bible class of Emmanuel Reformed Baptist Church of SeaTac, Washington, on Sunday, March 23, 2014, by Scobie Smith.
Let's turn this morning to Habakkuk chapter 1. Habakkuk chapter 1. It's been quite a while since we've been looking at the text of Habakkuk, but we are resuming today. And we left off roughly around verse 5. As you may recall, the first portion of this chapter, verses 1 through 4, introduces the problem that Habakkuk saw. Habakkuk, as prophet, was observing and witnessing great corruption and sin in the nation of Israel. And so in verses 1 through 4, we saw that he was, in a sense, complaining to God, praying to God about this problem of sin in Israel, and wondering how long is this going to go on. And now, starting with verse 5, we have the Lord's response, or his answer to that prayer, in the form of direct speech again to Habakkuk. And we're going to look at that response in verses 5 through 11. So let's just read this morning verses, we'll start with verse 1 again and get familiar with the text once more. Verses 1 through 11. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear, even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save? Why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are those who raise up strife and contention. Therefore the law is slacked, and justice doth never go forth. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous, therefore justice goeth forth perverted. Behold, among the nations, and regard, and wonder marvelously. For I will work a work in your days, which ye will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed from themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They shall fly like the eagle that hasteth to eat. They shall come all for violence. The set of their faces is forward, and they shall gather the captives as the sand. And they shall scoff at the kings, and princes shall be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap up dust and take it. Then he shall pass through as a wind, and pass over, and be guilty, imputing this his power unto his God. Where are we heading now in this answer today, as the Lord responds? We see in this section that the Lord speaks of the coming invasion of Israel, specifically of Judah, by the Chaldeans, who are also known as the Neo-Babylonians. And it paints a picture of this nation, including their fierceness and their greed and their power. And the Lord gives a fairly detailed description, doesn't he, of what this people is like. And if you were to read this in the original language, you would also notice that the language is very poetic. There's a kind of a rhythm to it, alliteration, and other poetic features, as you find often in other parts of the Bible, particularly in prophetic writings. And it makes one perhaps ask the question, why is there this amount of description about the Chaldeans? Why go into this somewhat detailed picture, and why portray them in the form of poetry? That's going to be one of the questions we're focusing on this morning. The setting here also is important to keep in mind. The Lord is pronouncing a kind of judgment, isn't he? That there's a nation coming that's going to invade Judah and conquer them. And we naturally think of this as being addressed to the people of Israel as a kind of a warning, a kind of a judgment foretold to them. But it's important also to remember at the beginning here that the setting is the Lord's response to Habakkuk, the individual, as a prophet. The context is God is responding now to this prayer, this kind of complaint that Habakkuk gave, and it is discourse or speech to someone who is a believer. As I said, you think at first of this as a kind of a announcement of judgment to the unbelieving, sinful people of Israel. Hey, the Chaldeans are coming. I'm warning you. And they're, as Habakkuk described in verses 1 through 4, they're corrupt, they're sinful, they're really an unbelieving people. But in fact, remember that the Lord is speaking to Habakkuk. And Habakkuk is a believer. And that's going to be an important point as we go through this passage to remember. There's more to this passage than announcing to unbelievers, you've sinned, judgment is coming, and you're going to be wiped out. There's a lesson here given to the believer. And the story, if you will, about this invasion, this conquest, doesn't really end with mere destruction of the people, with the kind of silence of wiping out all the people and no one's left. Believers like Habakkuk survived and lived on and saw the aftermath, the outcome of this invasion and what happened subsequently. And as an observer then, Habakkuk, knowing the Lord, believing the Lord, seeing the invasion and seeing and understanding what happened afterwards, could learn from this whole experience. And so there's a lesson here that a believer like Habakkuk, or like you and me, can learn from this, which the unbeliever, who is going to be invaded and killed, would not really have the opportunity to learn because he'll be dead. The believer who survives and witnesses the whole process of the invasion, of the conquest, and lives through it, and understands God's revelation, can actually learn something from this horrendous calamity that's going to come on the nation. And that is, I'm telling you in advance, the lesson or the point of the study this morning. If I could quote from Proverbs chapter 21, verse 11, it says, "When the scoffer is punished, the simple is made wise, and when the wise is instructed, he receiveth knowledge." In the first part of that proverb, that's Proverbs 21:11, it says, when the scoffer is punished, so you have someone over here who's a sinful, you know, wicked person, unbelieving, scoffing at the Lord, and the Lord brings judgment upon that person in some form or other, providentially, something bad happens, and it's kind of a providential punishment or judgment on that person. So the scoffer, when that happens and the scoffer is punished, then over here, someone else is made wise. The simple in this case, someone who doesn't have a lot of understanding, doesn't really have wisdom yet. That person is made wise. Well, how can that happen? Well, it's because the simple over here is watching and sees what's happened, sees everything that happens and sees the Lord's providence at work and is made wise. He, in Proverbs 19, verse 25, you have the same idea expressed, and there it says that the simple will beware. So he's alarmed and takes notice and is concerned. He begins to have a proper fear of the Lord by seeing what the Lord can do when the Lord is angry and brings judgment on someone else. And I think that is at the heart of what we're going to see here and learn from Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 5 through 11. So let's take a look now verse by verse here. We actually looked at verse 5 some weeks ago, And he says, "Behold among the nations and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you." So the Lord is about to do this work, this providential act in their lives, and it's unexpected. It's going to come as a great surprise. But now he's unveiling this to Habakkuk. And he gives a description, starting with verse 6. And I find that interesting. In a sense, you could even say that the description that follows, where the Lord describes the Chaldeans in some detail, that's a real mercy on the Lord's part. Because if this is unexpected, and they're not familiar, the Israelites aren't familiar with the Chaldeans, and this whole thing is going to be a surprise. If the Lord could have just said, "Hey, the Chaldeans are coming, and you're going to be invaded," and that's it. He could have said it in one sentence. But then the people would not have, or Habakkuk would not have really had a sense of, well, who are these people? And what are they like? And what's this invasion going to be like? How bad is it going to be? How are they going to treat us? The Lord could have left out a lot of information, but he doesn't. It's unexpected. The people are unknown. And saying less than he's about to say would just leave them in the dark, leave Habakkuk scratching his head, well, who are these people? But the Lord, in his mercy, as a matter of grace, in a sense, he condescends to give more information. And so there's a purpose here. He could have left all this information out that we're about to see in verses 6 through 11. But as a matter of grace, he provides it. And there's a lesson in there that he's giving us. So now in verse 6, he begins the description. "Lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess dwelling places that are not theirs." You may have a different translation. I'm reading from a slightly edited form of the King James Bible, where it says that this is a bitter and hasty nation. You may have words like violent, impetuous, impatient, ill-tempered, all sorts of other possible translations have been offered. And this is but very literally, the words are very common in the Hebrew language. It's the word for bitter and the word for hasty. And even though those are kind of simple, easy words, it's a little strange that the Lord is referring to a whole nation as bitter or as hasty. And I've often scratched my head, what exactly is that supposed to mean? How can a whole nation be hasty? Are they running around or they ride around in chariots all day and they're going quickly? What does that really mean? The Chaldeans, the history of the Chaldeans provides some context to this to help perhaps flesh out a little bit of what this is talking about. The Chaldeans were a people that lived in the south of Mesopotamia, so the southern part of modern Iraq, near where the Euphrates River comes into the Persian Gulf. And during that time, there was a lot of marshes. They were kind of known as the Sealand people. They lived in the marshy areas there. So they're south, downstream, down from the Euphrates, from Babylon. And in a sense, they're part of the broader Mesopotamian culture. But on the other hand, they're a bit farther removed. They're a little bit down south and out of the way. And they have dealings with people in modern-day, what we call modern-day Iran. That was Elam at that time. Later it was called Persia, the Elamites. But because of their situation being in the marshland, also they're organized in tribal groups, not really as one coherent nation, but they had five major tribal groups. And they're somewhat removed. As a result, they're not really part of cosmopolitan Babylonian culture. They're not part of that high society and prestigious culture that Babylon was at that time. Other nations held the Babylonian culture in high esteem. They would, in fact, imitate the Babylonians. The Assyrians, who were a nation to the north of Babylon, further upstream, up the Euphrates and up the Tigris River, Nineveh, for example, they, particularly at certain times, tend to imitate Babylonian culture. There were some peoples from the west called the Amorites, who were a Semitic people. who at certain times migrated into the Babylonian region, into Mesopotamia, and they also adopted Babylonian culture and language. So things like the language was something of high esteem, the religion, people would migrate in and adopt the gods of the Babylonians. And there were other things about the architecture and temples and artwork and so on that people would actually imitate. Babylonian culture had a long history, and so there was a kind of a prestige associated with it. Now, the Chaldeans were not quite so imitative. They're not quite part of that great party going on about Babylon, and they're outsiders to some extent. In addition, over the course of their history, over several centuries, they had many conflicts with the Babylonians and the Assyrians to the north. So they're repeatedly in wars and in fights with the Babylonians. So what you have here, as you look at their history, is a picture of a people who you might say are somewhat frustrated because they're close to Babylon. They're actually quite wealthy, too. They're along a certain trade route area. They have a certain dignity and a certain pride about their own culture, and yet they're left out. They're never on top. They're always sort of put down by the Babylonians. And so I believe that there's a kind of a cultural frustration among the Chaldeans that might be described as bitterness. So as I look at this first word, to be bitter, I think it might have to do with a kind of frustration, kind of an anger, a long instilled feeling of animosity because of this frustration. And I think it might be reasonable to say then to call that kind of a people bitter in a broad sense. And then there's this word hasty, and I'm not sure what else to say about that. I kind of suspect that it has to do not just with mere speed and how quickly they do things, but something to do with being opportunistic. They're off to the side here, and when opportunity arises, they strike. They come in and make raids on Babylon. When Babylon and Assyria are fighting with one another and weakening one another, then there's an opportunity, and they come in and strike. So they move in quickly at certain times when the opportunity arises. And their mentality is very much to gain wealth, to gain financially. As I said, they are on a trade route, and they tended to generally to be wealthy people. And we'll see here in this chapter that they were covetous, that they would invade so as to take wealth from other people, to take their lands, take their dwelling places and so on, things that were not the Chaldeans. So they're kind of a covetous people. So you can imagine them being sort of on the outskirts of Babylon, biding their time. They're not the strongest power, so they're not just going to come in at any time to wage a war. They're going to wait for the right opportunity. And when that arises, then they move quickly. They strike. So, yeah, bitter and hasty, those are reasonable words to use to describe them. If you were reading in the original language, and I certainly do encourage you, if you've ever had an interest in learning biblical Greek or Hebrew, there's much to be gained from doing so, and this is in some ways an example of this. Because if you're reading this in the Hebrew, you would still wonder why these particular words are used, because these are such common words. You could find another word for violent or frustrated, or another word for opportunistic or hasty. Why these particular words? Well, here the point that this is written in poetry comes up. If I were to read this particular phrase in Hebrew for you, you might catch a little bit of what's going on poetically. The words in Hebrew, the words are the bitter and hasty nation, or the bitter and hasty people. Well, in Hebrew, that's Hagoy hamar v'ha nimhar. And let me just focus on the words bitter and hasty, and I'll just leave out every other word. Mar nimhar. Mar nimhar. There's almost a rhyme there, isn't there? In fact, this is a form of poetic device called alliteration, where certain words are repeated. A rhyme is a case where you have a kind of alliteration, but it's at the end of the word, where the endings of words are the same, sound the same, and there's a kind of a flow that goes with that. Here you have an M sound, mar, and then nimhar. So there's an M in both words. And then there's also the R sound, mar, and then nimhar. And as one learns reading Hebrew and you see how Hebrew poetry works, this strikes you immediately as an example of that typical kind of Hebrew alliteration of words. And so the choice of the words here, bitter and hasty, if you were to wonder, as you're reading your English Bible, you wonder why those words are used, it has to do partly with the meaning, yes, frustrated, opportunistic, as we were saying, but it also has to do with just making poetry, picking the words that have the appropriate meaning, but also have the appropriate form or sound in the Hebrew language, so that you're writing poetry. So it'd be very much like if, say, you're trying to write a hymn in English, and you have some great ideas and sort of theological notions and ideas you want to put down in music and lyrics, and you're writing down your words, and then you realize you want the lines to rhyme. And then suddenly you have to stop and think again because the words you pick don't rhyme, so you have to think of words that mean the same thing, maybe, close to the same thing, but they rhyme now. And so you have to go through the dictionary in your mind and think, well, what's the word that rhymes? It means that. And it's a harder task, isn't it, to kind of figure out a word that now rhymes. It means the same thing, and it has a certain form or sound. Well, that's what's going on here. There's a choice of words that's based not just on the meaning, but also on the form. And so, by the way, here's another pitch for learning the original language. You can see this when you can read it in the original language, because you notice that there's more going on than just the meaning of the words. There's also the form, and there's poetry at work. So the purpose or the reason for the choice of these particular words in describing the Chaldeans is not just to give us that meaning, but also to give us a kind of a sound at the same time. Now, why would that be? Well, poetry introduces a kind of a flair to the expression, a kind of a rhythm, a kind of a beat, a kind of a repetition. And depending on the context of the poetry you're giving, the poem, that has a certain effect. And in this case, in this example, the poetry, I would say, enhances the effect of inducing fear in the audience. As God is declaring what's going on, it's not just a kind of a prosaic, ho-hum, oh, the Chaldeans are coming, and then this is going to happen, this is going to happen. There's a kind of a rhythm to it and a flair to the way it's being expressed. And you might wonder, how can that introduce fear? Well, think, if you recall Muhammad Ali, that great boxer, right? He would speak poetry, wouldn't he? He would come up with these strange kind of poetic expressions, and he would use that as a rhetorical device, really to try to induce fear in his opponent, because he would be boasting at the same time and doing it in this poetic way, which just enhances the sense of self-confidence that he had. So I think that's a bit of what's going on here. You can almost think of this as like Muhammad Ali, if you will. So this, the nation that's Mar Nimhar is coming, and so you have this repetition, and the effect is to induce fear. And I think that is the bottom line point that we should notice, even in that one expression. So, the people are bitter and hasty, And it goes on and says that they are going to march through the land, possessing dwelling places that are not theirs. Now, we're going to see more about this in chapter 2, but the basic gist here is that this people is a covetous people, and they come and they take what they want. They steal. So they're going to invade and conquer so as to plunder and take away everything you own. Later in chapter 2, we'll find that there's a just vengeance that will be brought upon them when other nations conquer them, the Chaldeans, and plunder them, and then mock them, because now it's happening to them, just as they did to other people. Now they're plundered. But here it describes them as marching through places to possess dwelling places, lands, and houses, and so on, that are not theirs. And that's really the essence of covetousness, isn't it? To desire something that isn't rightfully yours. It's one thing to desire something that you have the right to obtain and pay for and buy and say, oh, that's a good thing, I would like to have that, and it's available to me, and I will go ahead and purchase that. That's one thing. But to say, I like that guy's house, and I'm going to figure out some way that I can get him out of his house so I can own his house. Okay, that's covetousness, big time. And so the Chaldeans are doing essentially that kind of a thing where they're saying, gee, the Judeans have some pretty nice real estate over there and some wealth that's pretty attractive. Let's head on west and check that out. There's some light on this from Isaiah chapter 39. You may recall that there's a certain point in the history of Israel when Hezekiah was king, and certain Babylonian ambassadors came and visited him. And Hezekiah showed him everything, showed him his wealth, showed him how great his kingdom was. And they were very, you know, congratulatory and patting him on the back, saying, you know, you're great, Hezekiah. And then they went back. And the Lord, through Isaiah, rebuked Hezekiah, telling him that these people are going to come and take away everything that you own. Everything you just showed him, they're going to come and take. And it wasn't too smart of you to go and show them everything you have. It's kind of the underlying point there. They came at that time, this is much earlier now in the time of Hezekiah, they came and they visited and they congratulated Hezekiah, but they were looking on the wealth of Israel at that time with a covetous eye. Sort of taking stock, taking inventory, you know, taking notes. Oh, okay. And then they go back and remember. And now they come and they take everything that they own. And there's another point that could well induce fear. If you know there are people out there that are going to come and rob your house and they want to take everything you have and they have power to do so, then you start getting nervous. So again, fear is introduced. Verse 7, they are terrible and dreadful, and their judgment and their dignity shall proceed from themselves. And here we have really, I think, the key theme of this section here. They're fearsome, they're dreadful, they're terrifying. That is really, I think, the primary point that the Lord is impressing upon us. But then it goes on and says, their judgment and their dignity shall proceed from themselves. And here it's somewhat difficult to grasp exactly what's being spoken of, and you may have a different translation. It seems to be saying that they have their own system of justice or their own way of administering judgment. So their judgment or their justice proceeds from themselves. They have their own way of doing it. And that suggests that they're very independent. They're not part of, you know, the Babylonian legal system, you might say. Maybe you could even then say, use the word autonomous. They're an autonomous people. They're not depending on other people for their sense of justice and how that should work. And by implication from this mindset of autonomy, you could imagine that they would be somewhat proud. They have their own sense of dignity about themselves. And that seems to be the second part of this verse. Their dignity also proceeds from themselves. Their sense of self-esteem, their sense of elevation, to be more literal with the Hebrew, their sense of being lifted up, is something that comes just from themselves. It's not brought to them from someone outside. So they're very autonomous and independent people, and therefore also very proud. And now verse 8. Their horses are swifter than the leopards and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far, and they shall fly like the eagle that hasteth to eat. This speaks of speed, doesn't it? They are swifter than leopards and more fierce than the evening wolves. Not only are they fast, but they're likened to predatory animals. It'd be one thing to say you're swifter than ostriches, but an ostrich wouldn't really instill much fear. You kind of laugh when you see a swarm of ostriches charging at you. You might get out of the way, but you wouldn't have the same sense of fear. But if you see leopards coming at you at full speed, all right, it's not just speed then, it's also the predatory aspect of them. They are more fierce than evening wolves. What does evening have to do with that? Well, in the Hebrew there, they're sharper. It is literally what it says, they're sharper than evening wolves. And that has to do with the fact that it's at evening time that the wolves come out to eat. So by evening time, they're hungry. Their appetites are sharp. And they're very attuned to finding and killing their prey. So it's the evening wolf, rather than, say, the mid-morning wolf, that you're more afraid of. Because it's the evening wolf that it wants to come after you and eat your flesh. So there's that kind of element of speed or swiftness and the predatory aspect of this that again is introducing fear. Now how does speed have to do with this? It's one thing to be attacked by a group of people, by a nation, by an army that's large. But if they come in slowly and they're kind of lumbering along, well then you have time. You can react. You can respond. You can make preparations. During World War II, Hitler took over virtually all of Europe up until 1940, and then he paused before trying to invade England. And there was a bit of a window of opportunity where England was able to prepare a little bit. They were somewhat rather unprepared before that, but it gave them just enough time to increase manufacturing of aircraft, for example, and training and prepared defenses, so that just that amount of time helped. Because even though Hitler had moved quickly up until then, that lull in the just early summer of 1940 gave them a bit of an opportunity to prepare. When an army attacks in large numbers, but also quickly, the problem is you just don't have time to respond. You're caught flat-footed, and you just can't react in any way. In fact, that is, in World War II, the great strategy of Blitzkrieg that the Germans used. I've seen footage, I think it was from the invasion of Poland in 1939, where a classic example of Blitzkrieg. Blitzkrieg means lightning war. And the idea was to strike so fast that the enemy just couldn't react. So what the Germans did, they would send an aircraft first, particularly dive bombers, sweeping in ahead to pulverize the area. And then immediately after that would be the mechanized forces coming in at full speed, tanks and armored vehicles. So they're not advancing on foot with soldiers, infantry, just walking in slowly. They're moving in with mechanized forces as quickly as possible to essentially paralyze the enemy because they come in so fast. And so it's that rate at which the enemy comes that it can be so terrifying, because you can see it coming and you just can't do anything. And you realize it's just too late and you're about to be killed. So it's a very terrifying situation to be in. You're caught flat-footed. And that's the description the Lord is saying here about the Chaldeans. Their use of horses in particular. They come in so swiftly that they're even like an eagle that hastes to eat. If you've ever seen bald eagles around here, I remember seeing many on Whidbey Island. Sometimes you can watch them dive down on some prey. And they tuck in their, they jump off their perch, they tuck their wings in and steer a little bit with their wings partly pulled in. And at first it's slow, but as they just drop, it's suddenly just lightning fast at the end. And they have their legs out and their talons. You realize how big their talons are. And I don't know if, you know, the poor little vole in the grass even sees anything, but if he begins to see a shadow, it's too late. He's gone. And that's what's going on here. The Judeans might at some point maybe see the Chaldeans coming, but it's by then too late. Because they can't, they're coming in so fast that if they even begin to try to prepare their defenses, it'll be just way too late. So speed is fear-inducing as well. All right, verse 9. They shall come all for violence. The set of their faces is forward, and they shall gather the captives as the sand. Now this is an expression of how aggressive this people is. All of them come for violence. So violence isn't just an incidental of some of the purpose that the Chaldeans have. Violence is itself part of their motivation. They apparently like war. They're into the violent aspect of it. It's an opportunity to just let loose, perhaps. And so violence is what they're coming for. To destroy, not just to have the outcome of the violence, but the process as well is part of what they're enjoying. Now it says the set, in my reading here, the set of their faces is forward. Many of you may have some other translation for this next expression. This is quite interesting. This is perhaps the most difficult phrase in the whole book of Habakkuk. It's difficult to translate. Commentators disagree. Some just say it's not clear what it's saying. The problem here is that the word at the beginning is used only once in the Bible, in the Hebrew, and as a result, it's not clear what it means. There aren't other examples of the usage. So my translation here says the set of their faces is forward. That word set, that's the problem. What is that word in the original language? Some have translated it as the assembling of their faces is forward, or the totality of something. One translation says a sea of faces rolls on. And one could spend quite a bit of time trying to understand what this expression is. I'll just give you more or less the results of my attempt to study this. It's true that that word is used only once. And as a result, it's impossible to determine the meaning of the word from its usage elsewhere in the Bible, because it's not used anywhere else. It's just used here, this one spot. So that means we have to resort to etymology, to the historical linguistic methodology of looking at the root of the word and seeing perhaps how that root might occur in other words, or how that root might occur in other languages that are related. Well, even that's difficult, because the root of this word is used only in one other word in the Hebrew Bible, and it's the very common word for also. So the word for also in Hebrew, which is the word gam, has a root, and that root is the root used in this particular word. So how does that help? It doesn't help a lot. So you can kind of get a sense of how difficult it can be sometimes to translate the Bible, because there are certain verses here and there where words are rarely used, and it's not clear exactly what that word means. And this is one of those cases. The best that one seems to be able to do with this is to look outside the Hebrew language at related languages like Arabic. And there is a related word in Arabic that means to be abundant or to be much, and or sort of to be a kind of a collection of things. And that does seem to relate to the word also. This and this and this, also that, also that, also that. You're kind of adding things together, assembling things together when you use the word also. So there seems to be some sense of, some sort of concept of gathering together, assembling, grouping, collecting things together. And that seems to be the best guess that anyone has for what this word might mean. So what does one do with that? How does... What kind of translation could we come up with that might fit? Well, my suggestion is, and I'm actually seem to be agreeing with one of the standard dictionaries, my suggestion would be the gathering of their faces or the grouping of their faces in the sense of the movement together as a group of their faces, of the army, of the soldiers and men in the army, is forward. What does that mean? Well, imagine ranks of soldiers disciplined in formation. They're in ranks. And they line themselves up together, and depending on the formation, they're turned this way or that way. Sometimes soldiers, they all stand and they look to the left, or they all look to the right, or they all look forward. And I think what's being spoken of here is that disciplined lining up of soldiers in ranks such that together, as a group, their faces are all pointing forward as an army. So it's speaking here of, I think, of the literal orientation of their faces as army soldiers. And that seems to fit the context we're speaking of an army advancing, and they're moving in a disciplined way, quickly. And I think that image does also conjure up this sense of fear, doesn't it? Because you have not only you have two things going on here. You have the picture of a well-disciplined army that's organized, and they are moving together in unison, right? And they all turn and look at you forward, sort of like clockwork, right? They're in sync, synchronized. So that sense of a disciplined army is a bit of a concern if you're the opponent. This is not just some hodgepodge group of mishmash of people just wandering about. They're organized, they're trained, and they're disciplined. And then in addition to that, there is the picture here of being pointed forward. They're not looking backwards, sideways, but they're looking forward and they're looking at you. They're looking to come to Judah. Forward is us, where we are. So the picture here then is, again, fear-inducing, because there is the picture of intent. They are intent on coming after you and me in Judah. And that's why this whole verse speaks of how aggressive they are. They're not just passively sort of back on their heels waiting to be told what to do. They're intent. They're ready. They want to go forward. There's a kind of an irresistible force in them that wants to come at us. So that, I think, is part of the picture here, the turn or the orientation of their ranks is forward against us. And so they're quite aggressive, and it's something to fear. All right, so that was verse 9, and we navigated through that rather difficult phrase. And it goes on to say, they shall gather the captives as the sand, and they shall scoff at the kings. Princes shall be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. The picture is that they're going to conquer everyone. They collect captives like sand. So every individual captive is just a little grain of sand. And they're heaping up mounds and mounds of sand because they just have thousands and thousands of captives that they take. And then they can take basically any fortification. They are not concerned about how well fortified your city is, how tall the walls are, the gates, and so on. It doesn't matter to them. They just laugh because they are so organized, they're so industrious, they have engineering resources, they know how to build siege works. When it says that they shall heap up dust, this is the King James, and they pile up mounds of dirt, what that's talking about is making a siege, sort of a siege mound, a mound that lets them, a siege ramp, a ramper that lets them climb up over the walls. And that's, I mean, if you have, you think, you know, you build walls around a city and the walls are vertical, and you think, oh, people can't climb up that vertical wall, and if they try to, we'll drop, you know, boiling oil or something on them, right? Well, if the attacking army just begins to build a giant rampart with earth, then they'll just have a giant ramp, and they'll just walk right over the top of that wall. And that's what's being spoken of, and they're expert at that. So they're not concerned about your walls. They just laugh. They can take any fortification they want, and they can conquer basically any city that they have a mind to take. And so they're very confident. They're high in self-confidence. They ridicule kings. Princes are a joke to them. Little pipsqueak little rulers of these little cities. They laugh at the fortifications. So this is a people that's just full of bravado, a kind of egotism that they have. They are the superior people. Now you might look, you know, here you are in Judah and you think that's not a right attitude for them to have. They're just boastful. But it is intimidating, isn't it? If you've ever been around somebody who's very egotistical and you're a Christian, you're thinking, you know, that's just pride. That person is so full of ego and pride. That's what's wrong. Still, it's an imposing thing, isn't it? It's just to deal with. And when a whole nation comes with that kind of attitude, you have a psychological problem to deal with in that confidence of these wicked people who are invading. Well, then finally it says that like a wind, he's going to just pass through and cross over. This invasion isn't going to be forever. We're going to see more about this later. But they are going to pass through the land. They're not going to stay there forever. The Chaldeans are going to invade and leave eventually. And that's an encouragement, you might say, for those believers who are hearing this message and are going to observe what's going to happen, to know that there is an end to this. There is some encouragement to that. And then in the end, it says in verse 11 that he ascribes his power to his God. Or to put it another way, his military power is his God. So this is also one other characteristic of this people, is that they are idolaters. We'll see later that they actually, it talks about how they offer sacrifices for their weaponry. They really are so militaristic that in a sense they worship their weapons. And so their power, their own power, is for them a god. And that's just the idolatrous character of this people. All right, that's the end of this description. Let's pause there for a moment. What do we learn from this? What is the purpose of all these descriptive pictures about the Chaldeans? Well, as I have said, the main simple purpose is to instill the fear of God. This is, there's a fear of the Chaldeans, of course, but understanding this is coming about by the providence of God, the lesson really is to fear the Lord, who is raising up this horrible, fearsome invasion force. So that's the, if you will, the simple point, the basic point, that that those who hear this, who know this is coming, should fear God. But I would ask further, in order to really gain the lesson here from this passage, I would ask further again, to whom is this passage addressed? This is God speaking directly. To whom is he speaking? He's speaking to Habakkuk. Now, understanding, I think, who the audience is will help us understand the purpose. In other words, is this written to the people described in verses 1 through 4, the wicked general populace of the nation of Israel, the people who are about to die, who are about to be judged? I would say no. Many of them would not even hear this book, would not have the book of Habakkuk to read it, to know this. So this is not written as a kind of a general proclamation where Habakkuk is standing on the steps of the temple or, you know, standing in the gate of the city proclaiming this information. That's not what's going on. You see that in Jeremiah, but not here. And it says in the end that the Chaldeans are going to pass through and move on. So there's an end to this, and the Chaldeans leave, and there's an aftermath. Well, if the Lord goes on and speaks about the aftermath, to whom is he speaking? Is he speaking to the people who will no longer be alive after the invasion? No, that doesn't seem to be the primary audience in mind here. Those people are going to be dead and gone when the aftermath comes. So my conclusion is that this is not addressed so much to the unbelieving Israelites who weren't really even interested in the subject and who would die and wouldn't see the outcome of all this. I think the passage is for believers. So there's an announcement of judgment on the nation, yes. It's about the nation as a whole. But it's really an instruction or teaching lesson that's offered to believers who will witness all these things and have an opportunity to reflect on them, who will survive and live through it and thereby have an opportunity to reflect on what's happened. And so I see here a pattern that I quoted to you at the beginning from Proverbs chapter 21. When the scoffer is punished, the simple is made wise. Or in Proverbs 19:25, smite the scoffer and the simple will beware. There is a lesson given to, in a sense, to the third party. You have God as the first party. The second party is the wicked people being judged. And there's interaction going on there. God is judging. The first party is judging the second party. But then there's a third party over here watching. And the third party learns by witnessing the judgment that God brings upon the sinful group of people. See, there are different ways to learn the fear of God. You can read the scriptures and learn to fear the Lord from the words in the Bible, where it teaches us fear the Lord, the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Verses like that teach us simply by the words, and we can think about what those words mean and say, yes, I should fear the Lord. And that's good. And that takes us a certain distance. Second, though, one can learn to fear the Lord through one's own experience. The Lord brings about in your life various adversities, trials, hardships. In his providence, the Lord teaches us to fear him. If you've experienced what you discern as being a kind of chastisement providentially in your life, where something good is taken away from you and you think that could be chastisement, and you read Hebrews chapter 12 about how the Lord chastens you as a father chastens a son, and you're encouraged by that, and yet at the same time, you feel the sting of the chastisement, and you realize the Lord has power to do that, and he is to be feared. And so you're learning by actual experience in your life. And that's a second way to learn to fear the Lord. And of course, you need the words of Scripture to understand your experience as well. So you don't leave out the words. But experience is part of it. So words, mere words, add to that experience. Here we have a third way of learning to fear the Lord. And I would call this, if you want a phrase, a label for this, I would call this third-party pedagogy. Third-party pedagogy. And that's what I mean by where the simple standing over here, the third party on the side, and witnessing and learning as the third party from chastisement or judgment that the Lord brings on someone else. And so the third way of learning the fear of the Lord here is to see the experience of others and watch that and see the pattern and see what the Lord can do. And you begin to fear the Lord because you realize the Lord has power to do that to him. He has power to do that to me. And what's the difference between me and him? Well, we're both sinners. You know, but for the grace of God, I would be in that situation. There's really very little keeping me from being in that same situation. I should fear because it's just the sheer mercy and grace of God that keeps me from having that horrible experience. And but for that, I would be lost. And that, to be taught that way, that's a very rich way of being taught, I think. If you're a younger child, or if you were the youngest or younger child in a family, you may have witnessed elder siblings getting in trouble with the parents. And you hear it, and you see it, and you realize, I don't want to get into that trouble. And so sometimes the younger children learn and are made wise by seeing the errors and the discipline that the elder children get. And I think that's the same thing that's going on. Another passage, we won't have time to look at it, but you may recall in Luke chapter 13 that Christ talks about how when certain calamities fell on certain people, like the Tower of Siloam fell on 18 people and killed them, and Pilate mixed the blood of certain people with their sacrifices. The bottom line point of that was, unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. And the point, again, is somewhat similar, isn't it? That you see these horrible things that happen to these people, and you're witnessing it as a third party. And those are tokens of judgment. God is showing what his judgment is like. And we should learn from that. Because, but for his grace, he would bring the same judgment upon us. Unless you repent, you shall all likewise perish. And so we should learn from those examples of judgment, those tokens of judgment that the Lord brings providentially in the world, to see how gracious he is to us and how we ought to fear him, because the same could have happened or could happen or could have happened to us. So the lesson is, let's not only let's fear the Lord, but let's seek to learn the fear of the Lord as a part of our character as Christians. Let's instill it in us as part of our character. Let's take advantage of these methods of learning how to fear the Lord. Well, we must stop here, out of time. Let's close in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word, and not only your word, but your work in providence, that you have many times acted among your people and in the world to steer us toward the fear of you, the proper trust and love of you that we ought to have. And we pray, Lord, that you might sharpen our minds and hearts, that we might take up these providential lessons and learn from them, that we might grow, not just one day here or there, but that our whole character might be shaped and changed with this biblical and proper kind of fear of God. And we thank you, Lord, for working in us to conform us to the image of your Son. In Christ's name, amen.